Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles, let's go ahead and find 1 Samuel chapter 22. Chapter 22. We'll kind of pick up where we left off last week. I don't know about you, but I had a wonderful Thanksgiving in the Graham household. We ate a lot of food and did a little hunting, braved the elements on Black Friday, watched some football, and so it was all around banner week for us. So I hope you had a great week as well. If not, may today be a wonderful start to a new week. It's a great thing about how the calendar works. There's always another day, Lord willing, and always a new week for us to start. So we hope that this today has been uplifting for you and encouraging, and I hope we'll learn something today as we look at Saul. The story that we'll be reading today is in chapter 22, verses 6 through 23. So it's kind of the second half of chapter 23 that we didn't get to last week. And so with that being said, the story is going to focus back on Saul. So last week we looked heavily at David and how David was going here and there and yonder trying to escape Saul and manage new change and adapt and focus on how to stay alive, basically. And so today we're going to look at Saul's side of the story. And so we'll find some interesting things, and we'll have kind of one, well, really two, but it'll blend into one major idea we want to look at, kind of draw some application for us in our own life. So let's begin reading. We'll kind of read just a little bit and talk and read a little bit and talk and read a little, kind of, that's how we'll kind of roll today. All right, so verse 6. Now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. Now, the author doesn't give us a direct, like, this is how long it was between verse 5 and verse 6, but we can kind of understand that this is probably some time has passed between David initially leaving and then Saul finding out where David was. It'd be reasonable for us to believe that Saul found out where David was when about the time he gets to the cave of Adullam, because that's when the men, the 400 men, show up to where David is, right? If you remember that part of it last week, you remember he leaves, he goes to Nob to see Ahimelech, which we'll meet again today in a minute. Then he goes to Gath of the Philistines, and then he returns back to Adullam. That's where the 400 men meet him. It's probably about that time that Saul figures out where he is. All right, so let's keep reading. Saul was sitting at Gibeah. Remember, that's Saul's hometown. That's kind of the regional capital or the capital of Israel at the time. Under the tamarisk tree, on the height, there's that spear again, with his spear in his hands. And all his servants were standing around him. So the image that the author is trying to get us to understand is Saul is being kingly. At least in picture, he's sitting on his throne under the tree. It's probably where he dictated decree and judgment and y'all go do this and you go do that and all that. So that the picture is of Saul doing what a king ought to be doing. That from an image standpoint, okay? Now, Saul in verse 7 lights into a tirade. And here's what he says. And I want you to listen carefully. We'll kind of read the whole tirade and then we'll come back to verse 7, okay? So would you listen carefully to the language. Hear now, people of Benjamin. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Verse 8. That all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me. When my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, none of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. All right, so let's go back to the beginning of verse 7 and let's kind of walk through this because I want you to notice some things, okay? All right, so listen to what he says first. Hear now, people of Benjamin. All right, anybody think that sounds odd? Because I do. Because what is Saul? Saul's the king of... Not a trick question. Israel, yes. So why doesn't Saul say, hear now, people of Israel? Why does he only single out the tribe that he's from? Here, Saul is of the tribe of Benjamin. His capital is in Gibeah, which is in Benjamin. And he says, hear now, people of Benjamin. He doesn't say, hear now, people of Israel. So what should we denote from that? Very critical. He's elected. Here's the answer to the question. He's elected friends and family to his inner circle. That's what we would call nepotism. Right? You know, let me be king and then all y'all can get the spoils of my kingdom, my kingly reign. That's what's happened. Or else he would have said people of Israel. But he don't say people of Israel. You want to know why? Because they ain't people of Israel ain't there. Great English going on here this morning, right? They not around. Because he's elected his cousins and uncles and nephews and all the people from his folk are in positions of command and positions of leadership. That's why he says, now notice, he don't even call David by name. He won't even speak his name. He says, the son of Jesse. That's why he says, will the son of Jesse give you the things I've given you? Will he give you fields and vineyards? No. That's the answer Saul's going for. Will he put you in positions of command? No. Why won't David do that? Now, this is Saul. Now, again, this is not to say David wouldn't do this, but you got to think this is how Saul is looking at this problem. Saul is saying, no, he's not going to do that because he's from Judah. And why would a son of Judah give all you Benjaminites all that I've given you? So what is Saul doing? Playing to their greed and to their sense of tribal loyalty. Look, I was loyal to you. Do you think that guy's going to be loyal to you like I was? The answer Saul is trying to elicit, whether it's right or wrong. The point of that right now is not, is Saul right or wrong? That's not the point. The point is Saul is trying to elicit, no, he wouldn't do that for us. So then Saul uses that greed and that tribal loyalty to launch into verse 8, which is the dagger that he's trying to get at. And that is, why have you all conspired against me with the son of Jesse? No one told me that my own son made a covenant with this guy. Nobody. Look at what all I've done for you, and y'all can't do this one thing for me? Very transactional relationships going on here. Right? Then the coup de grace is what he says at the last part of verse number 9. Because verse 8. The coup de grace is, look at what Saul has cooked up, what conspiracy theory Saul has cooked up. Let's read it again. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son, who is that? Can't even call his name. Jonathan has stirred up my servant. Who is that? David against me. So what is the conspiracy now? Jonathan is the real perpetrator of this coup going on, and that he has hired out David as a hired assassin to kill me. Saul, he's losing it. Like, deeply losing it. Now, I want you to notice, let's go to verse 9, Ren, now, thank you. Now, I want you to notice who answers. Old Doeg, the pagan Edomite. Notice who doesn't answer. Who doesn't answer? The people of Benjamin, they don't say a word. So between verse 8 and verse 9, there is an awkward silence. Because Saul blurts out this tirade, waiting for somebody to say something, and nobody says anything except Doeg, I'm adding this in, the pagan Edomite. Who was he? The shepherd, the chief shepherd of Saul. He's a lowly shepherd. Now, he's the chief shepherd, so he's a little bit better than the, you know, low man on the totem pole, but he's just the shepherd. But the shepherd, not a dummy, sees an opportunity for advancement. Right? So what does he say? I mean, you can picture this. It's like you know, elementary school kids when one of them knows the answer and nobody else does. Ooh, 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 me, ooh, 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 ooh. I mean, that you can see his eyes light up. He's like, oh boy, I got this. So what does he interject? I saw the, no David yet, son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, verse 10. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So Doeg, the Edomite, the pagan, boom, here's what happens. All of Saul's friends and families, not a word. Okay? Verse 11. All right, so here's what happens. Then the king, we'll kind of read through this for a little bit. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. That's important. The priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king, like they should. They were summoned that king. They don't have any idea what's going on. Verse 12, here we go. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub," again, can't even call his name, right? And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me? And you and this," again, no David, "you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day." Now, time out. Before we go on, I said we were going to read a little bit. I just thought of something. Is David really lying in wait? He ain't even there. At best, he's at Adullam. At worst, he might be on his way to Moab at this time. I mean, Saul is just creating this scenario and feeding it and feeding it. And it'll get worse here in a minute. All right? Verse 14. So Ahimelech is going to respond. And he's going to give four kind of reasonings. Obviously, he's clearly caught off guard. He doesn't have any idea what Saul's talking about. He gives four things. So Ahimelech answered the king, "And among all your servants, who is so faithful as David?" That's reason number one. Like, David is a faithful guy. King, come on. "He's the king's son-in-law and captain over your own bodyguard." Your bodyguard. In other words, he's the guy closest to Saul to make sure Saul doesn't die. "And honored in your house." So he speaks to David's character. Like, king, this guy, what do you mean he's lying in wait to kill you? Where's he at? Right? All right. He keeps going. Verse 15. "Is today the first time I have inquired of God for him?" The answer is no. In other words, yeah, I've inquired of the Lord. I've asked the Lord on his behalf for things because that's my job. That would be like somebody saying, "Preacher, did you pray for them when they were in the hospital?" Well, yeah, because like that's what we're supposed to do, right? Because like that's his job. So he's like, "Yeah, of course I did, because that's what I'm supposed to do." Then Ahimelech goes on, "Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all of this, much or little." In other words, Ahimelech is like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And then tucked away in that, in verse 15, Ahimelech calls himself your servant. In other words, he's showing deference and loyalty to Saul. So he's showing deference and loyalty to Saul. He says, "I have no idea what you're talking about. I only did my job because that's my job. And are you sure you're right about David because of all of these character qualities of David that are positive and honorable? Now, verse 16. And the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." Now let's stop here for a minute. When we read this all the way through, does it not seem like Saul, now this is a conclusion or an assumption a little bit. It almost seems like Saul has already made up his mind on what he's going to do before Ahimelech even gets there. Right? Because he has created this conspiracy theory in his mind. Doeg has fed the conspiracy theory. And so his conspiracy theory must be correct no matter what anybody says. Right? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay? Now, verse 17. And the king said to the guard who stood by him. Now, stop right there. The guard who stood by him. You can insert another word there and go bodyguard who stood by him. Now, who did Ahimelech say was the captain over the bodyguards? David. So the bodyguards that Ahimelech was just talking about, Saul then turns to and says, "Turn and kill the priest of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me." Again, he's already made up his mind on what he's going to do, Saul has. But the servants of the king, the bodyguard of the king, and everybody there would not put their hand out to strike the priest of the Lord. So what do? Nothing. Right? They didn't do anything. Verse 18. Old Doeg, bless his heart. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn and strike the priest." And Doeg did not think twice about it. And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. That's 85 priests. Let's keep going. It gets worse. And Nob, the city of the priest, he put to the sword both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword. Now, what's interesting is that line sounds very, very familiar. Think back with me. Where have we heard that line before? We've heard it in chapter 19. No, excuse me. Not 19. Let's keep going. In chapter 15. Right? Listen to these words. 15 verse 2. Thus the Lord of hosts, says the Lord of hosts, "I have taken note of Amalek, what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. And listen, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." The only difference in that line of what Saul is supposed to do to the enemies of God is the word camel. So, what can we infer? What can we infer? It's real simple. Saul treats his own people worse than he treats his enemies. God gave him a clear command, "Go defeat my enemies," and Saul wouldn't do it. But when his own people don't do what he wants them to do, what does he do? He allows. Now, let's be fair. Saul doesn't give the direct command to Doeg, the pagan Edomite, to go kill all the people, all the man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, sheep, at Nob. But he sure doesn't stop him. And so he is at least complicit and gives the nod of approval for him to go do it. And so Saul treats his own people worse than he treats his enemies. That's telling, right? So, now let's finish the story. Chapter 22, verse 20. Here we go. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahab, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. So one of Ahimelech's sons, by the grace of God, makes it out. And he runs to David. Verse 21. And Abiathar told David, that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord, 85 of them. Verse 22. Look at David's response. And David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all of the persons of your father's house. Verse 23. Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me, you shall be in safekeeping. Now let me ask you a question. Ren, pull back up verse 22 for us. Look at what David says at the end. I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Was it David's fault that Doeg killed his father and all of... No, whose fault is it? Not a trick question. It's Saul's and Doeg's, right? They're totally responsible. But David, even though he's not responsible, takes onus and responsibility for what happens and says to Abiathar, hey, you stay with me now. I'll make sure, if you stay with me, I will keep you safe. And that's exactly what David does. Giving you a little foreshadowing, this is exactly what David does. For the rest of David's life, Abiathar will be a friend and confidant and priest of the Lord for David for the rest of David's life. In fact, Abiathar will be at David's side all the way through his death and will be a priest even into the reign of Solomon. Right? And so David keeps his word to Abiathar. Even though he doesn't have to. It's not his fault. It's clearly on Saul and Doeg. It's their fault, like they're held responsible. David still takes responsibility and says, hey, I'll make sure you are safe if you'll just stay with me. All right. So that's kind of the story. So we're looking at this whole David journey in the wilderness from Saul's perspective. And what can we learn? And I think there's two things. We're going to start big, and at the end of the first one, you're going to be like, but that's not me. Don't worry, we're going to get to us, okay? But if we read this story, here's what the immediate thought for me was. This is a primer on how you become a dictator. This is, Saul, listen, if we were to take this story, here's the story. Saul falls away from the Lord through mediocrity and jealousy. He becomes jealous of David, then he becomes fearful of David. And when dictators are fearful of people, what do? They try to kill him, which is exactly what Saul does. He tries to kill David multiple times. Multiple times. Three times in one day. Then, when his son tries to be like, Dad, Pop, what are you doing? He tries to kill him. He doesn't listen to sound advice. He goes off the rails. He creates fake stories that aren't real and then finds information to fit the preconceived narrative that he's already put together. That's the, like, look. I like a good conspiracy theory every now and then, but the thing you have to worry about conspiracy theories is you can always find information that makes your conspiracy theory seem right. Oh, well, why hadn't they let out the Epstein files? Oh. Well, you can find any information out there in the netherworld of the ether that fulfills your side of whatever you believe about that. See, I told y'all they was right. And you can have two people that believe vastly different things, and both of them absolutely believe they're right because their side of the conspiracy theory, they have found information to feed it. That's exactly what Saul did here. Saul found information that fed his preconceived notion of what was already going on that further allowed him to go down the drain. And then the final step of dictatorship is what? You kill your own people because you think they're out to get you. If we were to take this story and we were to set it back about 100 years and we were to read about it in history, you and I would both go 100 or 200, you and I would both go, he's a dictator. This is how you become a dictator. Just do what Saul does. You want to be a dictator? Be Saul. Now I know what you're thinking, but Pastor, but Travis, I don't have an empire. I don't rule a nation. How would I become a dictator? Glad you asked that question. Because we can take it one level further down that would apply to all of us is. So Saul is absolutely a primer on how to become a dictator, but he's also a primer on how to become a bad leader. And the reality is, all of us are called to be leaders in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's a leader in our family, whether it's a leader at work, and you say, well, I'm not the boss. That doesn't matter. I don't own my own company. That doesn't matter. You're called to be a leader wherever God plants you. Wherever you're at, God calls us to lead in some way, shape, or form. And it may be our own, only in our family, and that's cool, right? So how do you become a bad leader? And I want to hone in on, there's a lot of ways we probably could talk about that this morning, but I want to hone in on one thing Saul doesn't do that absolutely causes him to be an atrocious leader, and that is Saul is unwilling to listen to wise advice. He's unwilling to listen to wise advice. Let me give you five examples, including one today, five examples of Saul's unwillingness to listen to wise advice. In chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, Saul does not listen to Samuel's advice to wait on him to offer the sacrifice. Samuel says, hey Saul, wait on me. I'll offer the sacrifice, then we'll go defeat the Philistines. And what does Saul do? He doesn't listen. He gets impatient, he does it himself, and they end up losing. In chapter 15, which we just read, Saul doesn't listen to Samuel again. When God, through Samuel, says, hey, destroy all the Amalekites. And what does Saul do? He does his own thing. He does whatever he wants to do. He doesn't listen to wisdom from Samuel. He does his own thing. And as a result of that, guess what happens? God says, whoop, taking my spirit off of you. You will no longer be the king. You and your family will not reign forever. Okay, verse 19, he doesn't listen to his son Jonathan in verses 4 and 5. Jonathan tries to persuade his father that David has done deeds that have brought good to you. And what does Saul do? Tries to kill David anyway. In chapter 20, in the same cycle, Jonathan again says, why should David be put to death? What has he done? And Saul doesn't listen to him, and in that case, tries to throw a spear at him. And then today, Ahimelech, chapter 22, says, but King, David is all of these good things. And what happens? Saul not only kills him, but his whole family and everybody he brought, and then total wars the city of Nob, burns and pillages everything. Saul doesn't listen to wise advice when people speak to him. But there's another way Saul doesn't listen to wise advice either. It's when everybody around him is silent. In today's story, all the people of Benjamin, that's all his friends and family, that's all the people that he put in positions of power and authority, when he goes on this tirade against David, what do they do? They don't say anything. And then when he turns to them after he had already made up his mind to kill all of them, none of them act. It's only the pagan who he listens to and who acts at his command. Saul doesn't see that silence is speaking volumes against what he's asking them about and then asking them to do. Bad leaders don't listen to wise advice when it's spoken, and they do not hear the sound of silence when wise people don't speak. Right? We've all been in those meetings. We've all been in that people when somebody is running off at the mouth, blah, 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 blah. And everybody in the room is like, God, when is he going to be quiet? When is she going to be quiet? I've got an answer, but they're not going to hear me, so I'm going to sit here and be quiet. And that's what happens. That's what happens. I'll tell you a story real quick. Two stories real quick. So one is one I had a coach years ago, and he made a profound statement that I've always remembered. He said, "If I'm talking to you and trying to correct you, that means there's something in you I'm trying to get out." He said, whenever I'm quiet and you mess up and I don't say anything to you, it's because I've realized you're not going to listen to me. Right? You're not going to listen to me. Right? So, funny story. I'm very cautious about telling stories where it makes out to me to be like the wise person. But this was profound in my evolution as a leader. Many years ago, it was before we moved here, we were in Athens, and I had a great idea for children's ministry. At that time, I was a youth pastor in children's ministry, which I realized vastly different skill sets are needed for those. I was really great at a youth pastor. I was marginally okay as being a children's pastor, right? Because you can't run children's ministry like you do youth ministry. It's vastly different needs. I found out that the hard way. And so I had a team. I was smart enough to do this. I put a team together of really great children's ministry leaders, but I had this great idea of what we were going to do on Sunday night or Wednesday night, one of the two, for children's ministry. I mean, in my mind, it was like A++++, star, superlative, underlined, you know, great idea. And I came in there, that meeting, I had all my paperwork, I had my plan laid out, handed out copies, and as I was going through this, I could see the eyes of the people, and they were like, and so I was like, hey, so this is what we're going to do. Y'all have any questions? And bless his heart, this sweet, precious lady over here said, hey, this ain't going to work. And I'm like, but yeah, it is. She's like, no, this is not going to work. And she began explaining why it's not going to work. And in that moment, I realized, oh. So then I was like, well, what do y'all all think? You know, because me and her are talking over here, and it's like there's six other people. It's like, hey, what are y'all going to think? And they were all in unison. Yeah, I think her idea is a whole lot better. Right? And so then, as a leader, you got a choice to make. We can ride or die with my idea, or we can do what everybody else in the room wants to do. And here's the kicker. It was my idea, but I wasn't going to be involved in none of it. Because at the same time, we had youth ministry stuff that I was in charge of, right? And so I was either going to be like, no, y'all going to do it my way, or y'all going to be the ones actually running this. So this is what y'all want to do. Now, thank the Lord, in a moment of whatever, I said, okay, well, if that's what y'all want to do, that's fine. It worked flawlessly. Their idea was great. But in that moment, I had the opportunity to listen to wise advice or not. Thankfully, in that moment, I chose to listen to wise advice. But Saul, what does he do? He is unwilling at every turn to listen to wise counsel and to listen to the sound of silence in the room and to read the room. And he just barrels ahead doing whatever he wants to do. And it ends tragically every single time. So here's the question, and I'm going to leave you with these four thoughts as we go kind of go home that are application related. How can we make sure we don't end up like Saul? How can we make sure we are good leaders, not bad leaders? I got four ideas for you. Number one, if we want to be a good leader, we need to surround ourselves with wise people. We need to surround ourselves with wise people. Now, I got a bunch of verses listed in Proverbs. The Proverbs have a ton to say about wisdom and seeking wisdom. And I'd encourage you to go back and read those when you get home. Trust me, they will be to your benefit. There are a lot of verses in the Proverbs that talk about surrounding yourself with wisdom, with wise people, and listening to it. Here's the second thing. When wise people speak, I'm guilty of this. I'm speaking to myself here. Don't be quick to say, I know. You've been around that person. You're telling a story and you're like, yeah, I know. And so what do you do as the person who's speaking? You don't say anything anymore because they already know. And here's the thing that I realized this week as I was writing this sermon. Is if I'm the person that is listening to wise people and I continually say, I know, I might know the thing that they are saying in that moment, but I jip myself of the thing they were going to say in the next moment that I may or may not have known. Because if you're talking to me and I keep, or if I'm talking to you and you keep saying, oh, I know, well, then I'm just going to stop talking because you already know. And why am I going to just waste my time and your time on something you already know? But what you don't know is what I might have said next that you didn't know. So I need to be the person who is, when I'm seeking wise advice, I don't say, I know all the time. Because while I may know what you're saying then, I may not know what you would have said next. And wise people listen and they take in information, whether they know it already or not. Right? So, surround yourself with wise people. When they speak, just listen. Consult. I added this one in. Consult wise sources. Listen. We live in an era where you and I have more sources for information available at our fingertips than any generation in the history of the world. And you know what? A bunch of those sources are dog water. They are terrible, right? Consult wise sources. If you are questioning whether a source is wise, ask Pastor Logan. Ask me. We will be glad to help you, right? There are a lot of sources out there that are an absolute waste of your time. I said this years ago, and I mean it. One of the most dangerous aisles at the Barnes & Noble bookstore is the religion and Christianity. You want to know why? Because when you go down the other aisles, you know you're getting nonfiction. And you're getting fiction. And you're getting gardening. And you're getting animals. But when you go down the religion aisle, you ain't got a clue what you're getting. Because it may have a great title and be absolute trash in between the pages. Consult wise sources. Be careful. Right? Here's the last thing. Here's the last thing. James 1:5. Our teenagers, Pastor Logan knows this one. Pastor Logan walked through James this fall with our students. This fall? Summer? Summer. Close enough. Spring and summer. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. In other words, pray for wisdom. You want to be a good leader? Pray for wisdom. Put yourself around wise people. When they speak, listen. Consult wise sources and pray for wisdom. Because James clearly says, if you need wisdom, ask, ask God for it, and he will give it to you. We need to take God up on his offer. All right, here's your challenge this week. Listen, don't be a dictator. Be a good leader. Consult wise people. Consult wise sources. Listen to wise people when they speak and pray for wisdom.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.